Hi, this is Mike McNamara, and you're listening to All Marine Radio on your home for it, the one and only All Warrior Radio Network.
Joining us on this second day of September is none other than the man, the myth, the legend himself, from atop his bell tower in Quantico. Chris Woodbridge joins us. Woody, how are you?
Mac, how's it going?
It's actually, you know what? I mean, it's going great. I continue to have just incredible experiences going around the country doing post-traumatic winning, and it's a life-changing experience. So even in the midst of this COVID craziness, I could not be more professionally pleased with the work that I'm doing. So thank you for asking. How's life at the Gazette?
Well, you know, it's funny you say that. It's very much the same thing here. You know, this and you and I haven't talked, at least not on the air in quite a while. And you know, this craziness, as I think we all view it, most of us view it, has had very little impact on the business of the Gazette. And you know, we've proven ourselves to be largely quarantine proof, both in terms of editing and production of the magazine, both in print and online, and also the demand and the reception from you know, our readers and members of the association. So in some ways, it's allowed us to focus a little bit more on some of the, you know, the quality of the product, quality of the dialogue, and really hasn't caused too much of a hiccup with production of the magazine. So I know exactly what you're talking about. This has been an interesting few months, and we continue with the mission.
Let me ask you: you're a business operator. Not so much an owner, but kind of an owner, but in a figurative sense. But how does this change business going forward? Does everybody got to be at a physical site 5 days a week? Do they need to be there maybe 1 or 2 days? And what does that do for the demand for office space and things like that? I'm curious about your thoughts about that.
Exactly. No, this is all very much in the learning curve right now, you know, both in a narrow sense for, you know, for the association foundation, for our facility here, recognize that also it's very, you know, very kind of a eclectic or diverse operation that we have. We have, you know, everything from a brick and mortar retail facility in the Marine shop, selling uniform items, primarily dress uniforms, and then other Marine Corps gear and books, professional reading books from the reading lists, all the way to our office spaces and our production of the magazines, our running of web content and all that. So it's not a one size fits all situation. But your point about space requirements and what I'll call attendance requirements are really changing. And again, we've learned a lot that there are functions that go on just as well in a what I like to call a distributed paperless office environment. You know, we're doing distributed operations and we're using a paperless editorial and production process here, using collaborative tools, using the web. We've learned a lot, and I think that's going to change for a lot of businesses. For some businesses, it's not going to change at all, and in fact, it creates a real threat. And the close to home example I use for that is when we talk about uniforms and officers' uniforms or senior enlisted dress uniforms, we're talking about the requirement to do tailoring. That is a hands-on business. You are up close and personal with other humans, not just when you're doing a fitting for for a newly commissioned second lieutenant coming out of officer candidate school or at the basic school, but for those tailors and seamstresses who are working to build those uniforms out of whole cloth. That is not something that you can do from home, and it's not something that you can necessarily social distance as you're using a measuring tape to take the inseam measurement on another human. So, again, there's risk involved there with the restrictions put on that sort of physical contact. And we went through here in Virginia, obviously the periods of shutdown where we had to significantly cut back the operating hours for the marine shop, and that has second and third order effects that continue now as folks are who work in that environment are also having to deal with requirements for homeschooling again, which is a universal in some of the counties here in Northern Virginia.
Yeah, but you look at I was reading an article about New York City, and you're talking about businesses that own floors of huge buildings who are now saying, yeah, we might need 10-15% of those employees to actually physically be there after what we've gone through for this prolonged period of time. And distributed ops means the way we hire will be different. We need you to be capable of working independently. And if you can't do that, you add to our babysitting bill because we have to bring you in and we have to supervise you. We don't need you. We're looking for an independent operator, which is interesting because that means you're going to have to be self-disciplined. One of the things I talk about in post-traumatic winning is that after you've gone through traumatic stuff in your life, as you put your life together, the first goal of post-traumatic winning is you got to learn to coexist because it's not going away. The second goal is you got to learn to live with self-discipline. And while it's fundamental to being a sustained success, if you want to be, if you're dealing with traumatic events and you have that stuff rolling around in your head as well as other, if you don't learn physical fitness, if you don't learn financial fitness, and if you don't understand how to control alcohol and drugs in your life and then develop wellness practices, you are going to be in the ditch on a regular basis, and it makes life pretty difficult. And so add this layer to it, it's kind of interesting that, one of the qualities that, is fundamental to being a good Marine, a successful Marine, and something that has been a hallmark of the Marine Corps, self-discipline, is going to become at a premium because it adds to the bottom line of corporations.
No, you're absolutely right. The requirement for you are responsible for yourself and you are accountable to yourself is part of that that self-discipline, and unfortunately that is that's not necessarily part of the culture of a lot of businesses. There's an awful lot of top down, as you put it, babysitting style management in a lot of businesses that now, we can't afford to do that, nor do we necessarily need to afford to do that. It's interesting. You mentioned New York City, my hometown. Several thousand businesses are closing those facilities and choosing to leave New York City because the restrictions and the impact on their workforce have gotten so negative that it's simply not worth it to them to pay, number one, the rents involved in having a brick and mortar store in New York City, and number two, to pay the taxes involved in doing business in New York. And that extends from small businesses. We love to use the term mom and pop businesses, be those restaurants or retail facilities, all the way up to some of the big international companies who had flagship storefronts on Broadway, Times Square, Fifth Avenue. Those very high visibility and high dollar, high rent areas are closing those flagship facilities. So the impact of that is going to be felt for years, if not decades.
Is New York City heading back to How would I say it? The period that we knew in the what would have been Woody the late the 70s and the early 80s when you didn't want to go
70s up through the early 80s.
Are they going to head back to a period of that until they can figure out the security situation and
I think that's the fear. I think that's the fear. I know talking to my family and friends up there, that's what folks are concerned about, and some of them certainly you know report at least the impression that it's you know it's almost there now, and again having grown up in the city at that time and a lot of my friends know this as well. It was dangerous at times, and it was so different from the way the city was even 5-10 years ago.
Right.
Just in terms of the security, the vibrancy, the business, the growth, it's definitely a risk, and it's not necessarily a done deal. It's not it's certainly preventable with the right kind of leadership.
Yeah, I don't think that guy's the guy, though. Just that I could be wrong about that. I don't mean to turn this into a political forum, but you watch that guy on TV, you're like, did New Yorkers actually elect that dude? Or did he get appointed by somebody that on the down low that we don't know about? But it is pretty amazing. I want to switch gears. I want to ask you real quick, the stunning leadership petri dish that is the United States Navy. Since the last time you and I spoke, we watched an American amphibious warship burn for 4+ days in port, which was amazing to watch. I'm not sure the forest all burned for four or five days at sea when it blew up off the coast of Vietnam. Watching that was amazing. I was up in Montana and saw the news and then saw the first day and a half. And then I come back 3 days later and it's still on fire. And I just could not believe it, Woody. So and then layer on top of that, that it might be, you know, they're investigating that arson was the cause of that. The mainstream media now, the Wall Street Journal wrote an article saying that the President of the United States needs the United States Navy right now, and the Navy's not up to the task. Give me your thoughts on that.
You know, you have to look at it. There is definitely something systemic going on. And it's hard to pinpoint, the root cause, the origins behind this. The Navy across DOD, the Navy has been both a bill payer in terms of overall budget and manpower. They've made internal cuts to manpower, over the last 10 years. They were a bill payer to a degree during the years of, protracted counterinsurgency and land war. But the strategic nature of the naval service and the United States Navy in particular, I think was overlooked for several subsequent administrations. And now we're kind of paying the butcher's bill on that. It's a very complex issue. And it's wrong also to make sweeping generalizations about the entire service. However, the drumbeat of these major incidents is and should be a wake-up call and a warning, a red flag that, again, and I know I've said this, I think, on the show in the past, the United States – for over a century has been a world power because we are a naval power. And if that is jeopardized, if we lose our power, control, and influence in the commons, the maritime commons, the impact on our economy, the impact on the world economy, on trade for us and our partners, and on overall security, regional and local security around some of the key maritime choke points of the world really becomes at risk. And that is more significant a change event than anything we've seen to date regarding the pandemic or anything else. So putting that that strategic arm, that strategic force at risk, and allowing it to develop these systemic problems, these systemic challenges, again, puts the standing of this nation as a world power at risk. And I think that's the kind of the heart of that article, and I think that's where this is pointing to. Now, what's the solution? There are times when there have been what I'll call the full court press to try to determine a problem and then chart a solution for the armed forces in general or a service in particular. I don't know that it can necessarily be done internally, but I also don't think that this is the area where a gold ribbon panel or a congressional review is something that's going to be productive at all either. So I think there has to be a really hard and honest look at kind of the trajectory that our naval service in general and the Navy in particular, I don't want to say the most important, but among the most important strategic arms of the United States, needs to be looked at. And to think overall that these are not in some way a systemic issue, I think would ignore the problem. And so that
you see it. I mean, whether you want to talk about the SEALs, whether you want to talk about surface warfare collisions, you know, I mean, it's like this nightmare that you don't think can get any worse, and then all of a sudden it does. I mean, I have friends when, you know, all of a sudden the headline of arson suspected as a cause of fire on the Bonhomme Richard, they didn't even get to anger, for a day because they were just stunned. I can't believe that. Right? That is that where we're at now? That you have a strategic asset because it was retrofitted to accommodate the F-35, which changed the whole nature of that thing as an asset. That thing is now maybe will never go to sea again. And then we couldn't knock the fire down, which is fundamental to, you know, to the ship is built to compartmentalize damage and couldn't do that in port. Now, a lot of people would say, oh, well, this, that, and the other thing. Well, you know, a lot of other people would say, well, bullshit, man. Bullshit. In port, not underway, and you can't knock a fire down? Like, so I'm not sure which problem is more significant, your ineptitude or your moral corruption. So I don't know how you get your hands around that, Woody. I mean, seriously. And the that's going to be the lead agency that confronts the Chinese. Well, good luck, man. Good luck to you.
My point exactly.
All right, I want to talk about Major Lauren Serrano. Exactly. She is the 2019 General Robert E. Hogaboom Leadership Writing Contest winner for an article written called In the Arena. She was on yesterday with me. Somebody sent me an email and said, hey, Mac, Lauren Serrano regrets some of the things she said on your program. You need to get her back on. And so I tracked her down. I said, hey, word is that you're growing as a human being. We need to talk about it. So she's written a really, really interesting article. And so so this is an opinion question to you based on her article. And now let me just tell you this. Lauren participated in a discussion on gender in the Marine Corps as a lieutenant captain. And what she wrote, Women Don't Belong in the Infantry, I think that's close to the title, not sure. But, I mean, she was trending on Twitter. She said, she told me she didn't even know what that was when she first heard it. You're trending. What does that mean? And so, anyway, she gets invited to be in on national television forums, and pretty heady stuff for a pretty young person, not media savvy, trying to learn as quick as you can, trying to do what you're told, trying to pay attention to what the PAOs tell you in terms of you can talk about this, you can't talk about that, this is the Marine Corps' position on this, blah, 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 blah. Then a couple years later, she writes another article, more than a couple, and where she questions this movement to a unisex physical fitness standard that I'm watching. As a woman now who stayed in the Marine Corps and had two children, I'm not interested in being, you know, a guy. I don't want to serve in the combat arms. This is my career, but I'm nervous now that there is no place in the Marine Corps for me. And so another very interesting kind of gender-oriented article is that, is there a spot for me? And so she now writes that, is it possible to participate in these discussions in a day and age where cancel culture runs rampant, and not be punished for those positions that you've taken? I'm sure you saw the guy from Boeing who wrote an article that appeared in the Proceedings in 1987. He just resigned 2 months ago because that article got dredged back up and said that a position that he wrote on, 33 years ago, negates his ability to do his job. So I'm curious your thoughts on her thoughts.
I think she is, first of all, number one, a very courageous Marine officer for writing on these issues. Number two, a very good writer. I mean, very solid written expression.
By the way, it's what we want. We don't want people to be afraid to debate this shit, right? Marine officers, right? Marines, exactly. We're supposed to go and let it rip and not be afraid of that. But
we're supposed to have the moral courage to look at the most sensitive, divisive, use any adjective you want, issue, social issue, and take it head on and try to make the service better. And, you know, good on her for doing that. I think what the most recent article, which was the winner in the recent Hogaboom contest, is it's unique and uniquely valuable in that it is a personal view of the impact of doing just that, of doing what we tell you you should do. And guess what? As you pointed out, it is not all kudos and backslapping and positive impact. And I believe that the negativity is it is symptomatic of our overall aversion to civil discourse and informed dialogue, not just in the Marine Corps, but right now in our society at large. You know, the term you used, cancel culture, is certainly a good descriptor. But what it really comes down to is a fundamental inability to respect divergent opinions and ideas. And that is, again, an extremely dangerous thing. I mean, yes, to society at large, but it's frankly unacceptable in the Marine Corps, where we value independent thought, where we do not require conformity of thinking amongst Marines and our leadership. That's not connected to disobedience to orders or anything like that. That is connected to critical thinking and independence of ideas, something that we have always valued and we have to continue to value. There ought not for Marines to be anything that we quote unquote can't talk about, that we shouldn't talk about. I think that's some of the heart, the impact, the reaction.
Yeah, but Woody, you're the custodian of the Marine Corps debate forum. And I mean, and I'm, you know, and I do this, you can't get Marine officers to come on and talk about issues. No, I don't. No, I'm not going to do that. So I understand what you're saying. And to me, she's the person that should get promoted. But the question, you know, but again, I think reality says you do that at the peril of your career. What say ye in a similar position as I am, although you're a little bit more buttoned up than I am?
It's a different type of media.
Exactly.
But no, to your point, I see it as well. Right. I see a hesitancy. And, you know, again, looking at what, you know, Major Serrano's experience has been, you know, maybe it's with, you know, with good grounds. You know, there is risk out there. If you say something in a public forum, or in some cases, even a semi-public forum, as in, you know, writing a paper for academic purposes, but something that isn't necessarily published, but that is public domain and searchable and findable, there is a risk of exposing yourself to attack from those with different views and frankly the energy and the time on their hands to my words, you know, hunt people down, which is again, it's not part of you know, any form of freedom of expression that I'm familiar with, and so as a, you know, as an editor and publisher, I actively seek folks to write in these areas, but I'm with you. There's a significant or serious hesitancy on the part of particularly some junior officers to go down that road. The other side of that, I will tell you, is there's no hesitancy at all, and also no filter whatsoever in some of the readership, the writership that I deal with. And unfortunately, because of that, a lot of that is not worth publishing. you know, I'm not going to publish what I call fact-free attacks or opinions.
Right. No, but what you and I have, and what I would tell you, and I don't care if I was doing this over the air talk radio in Northwest Minnesota and Eastern North Dakota, what people enjoy is, and the cool part about doing it in that part of the country is that, like, you know, you'll get senators and the governors to come on and you can talk about this stuff with them. And what people enjoy are smart people, tough issues, and footnoted, articulate discourse. You know, and dare I say, in my mind, the model for that is the McNeil Lear NewsHour, when you would have those guys sitting around and talking about something, and they were respectful, they were articulate, and it was, you know, you learned the whole time. Even when you didn't support somebody's opinion, you learned from it. And
exactly.
It was pretty amazing. And so I so to me it's I don't know. It's a trend that I see, that the media is something that should be you should shy away from, and that when you do go in front of it, boilerplate is what you preach. Do not get out of your lane, you know, go through that gauntlet and then be done with it and don't go back there. That's why, to me, General McKenzie is kind of an interesting guy, because he gets off the page, right? One of my favorite things he said at a press conference when he was at the Pentagon before he was CENTCOM was asked about South China Sea and islands there. And he said, look, you know, we're not intimidated by that. Lest anybody forget, we have a fair amount of experience in the region with island fighting. And you're like, that's not how they script it. That's not how they script it when they put this stuff up anymore. But you don't find too many people like that, you know, that are willing to have an open exchange, very deliberate, very controlled, and very much intimidated by it. And maybe that's the right career move. I don't know. But it just seems to me that officers like Major Serrano, they're the people that you want because they're the they're not afraid to have a point of view. They're not afraid to articulate it. And we need that vibrant discussion. We don't need the bobbleheads. And I don't know. I don't know. And again, you and I have talked. The bobbleheads are how we got to Iraq. The bobbleheads are how we, you know, expanded the ground war in Afghanistan. And so we don't need that. And I don't know how you do that unless you promote that. So anyway, just a thought.
Exactly right. No, I agree with you. And you know, the litmus test in my lane is it you know, is it fact based?
Right.
Is it a rational? Is it a logically sound, valid argument? Is it respectful, tactful to all parties? And ultimately, the biggest litmus test is it constructive? Is it finding a solution and making a recommendation that makes us better? And if it's kind of like a, you know, like a good marriage, if it doesn't have all of those pieces, it's not going to work. It needs all of those pieces. And if you're true to those elements, those four elements, you can take on any issue, any social issue, any divisive issue that's out there. Again, if you use those four elements, and you know, I think it's important because these are issues, and you know, you talk about the issues of gender, of race, etc. These are some of the most divisive, quote unquote, sensitive issues out there, but they're human issues, and the Marine Corps is a human service. Our combat power wears MARPAT utilities and has a brain and a heart, and the ability to use that combat power as a leader, to employ that combat power, is about building the trust and the cohesion among a very varied group of young people, and that's our combat power. So anything that we can do that's constructive in nature towards making that organization better needs to be out there, needs to be part of the dialogue.
Yeah, but we can't have and I'll give you an example. We can't have a grown-up discussion about race in our country, because if you ask hard questions about the events, you're going to be branded a racist. If you don't buy the narrative of professional athletes that there is systematic oppression in this country. Mark Esper just said, quoted in an Associated Press article today, the good news is that what they tell me is anecdotal incidents of people saying callous things or insensitive things or straight up racist things to him, and that's in his conversations with service members as he's, you know, in the Pacific. But so when you talk about this really serious issue of systemic racism that you and I grew up with, that we've seen, and now you're watching it now play out in the country after we've elected a black president twice, and we've seen all the progress since the 60s, and people say that stuff, and if you just ask them, hey, footnote that for me, where do you see this? Because liberals run the education system. Do you see it there? They run all of our major cities. Do you see it there? Show us so we can do something about it. You're going to be labeled a racist. And that discussion, and I would tell you, because I've kind of investigated it, you know, relative to police violence against, you know, black men in this country. If you look at the Washington Post database, if you look at the FBI database, those numbers have come down every year since Ferguson in not a small way. In a big way. I think they're down 56%. You look at across the nation and say, if you footnote, I want to say last year there was maybe somewhere between 10 and 20 incidents of unarmed people. Well, if you start doing the footnotes and saying, okay, how many used a car as a weapon to try to run a police officer over? Okay, that was six of them. And you begin to start footnoting those things. You get down to a small handful. But we can't even have that discussion, right? Because then that we say, okay, so when we rack and stack, if Black Lives Matters, then what? That is not the number one priority. Black-on-black violence in the form of inner-city murder is number one. Two, black pregnancy among black girls that keeps you in cyclical poverty has to be up there, and throw in Hispanic girls too, because they are multiples of what white and Asian girls are, and that and any study says that leads to cyclical poverty, right? And so 50 years after Dr. King's march, 52 as a matter of fact, 52 years after that march, we can't have, it's like you're looking for the adults to come home. Like, when is the babysitter going to come home and like make order out of this chaos that my sisters and I have going on right here? When are the adults going to come into the room so we can have a grown-up conversation that everybody has a seat at the table, that everybody's going to get listened to? And Woody, I'll tell you, I mean, it's distressing because I don't see us having that conversation yet. And so we can't, I mean, for those of us who've served with black Marines, Hispanic Marines, sailors, airmen, and soldiers, and who don't give a shit about race, and we've committed our lives to that, we'll fight for it. We'll change. We'll change it. But we got to have an honest conversation, and then let's point it out, and let's get after it. I think it's pretty discouraging what you see in this country, in that we're not having that conversation. We're just screaming at each other, and we've devolved into these two camps relative to news, and it just doesn't work. And I don't know. And then I don't know. What changes this? Somewhere in there, there's a question, Woody, but I think it's really discouraging for people that want to make a difference. But you watch this stuff on TV, and you can't say, when LeBron James says, "I'm afraid we're being hunted," if you say, "Yeah, but that guy in Wisconsin, he had resisted arrest, he had been tased, continued to resist arrest, and then there was a knife on the floorboard of his car when he opened the door. He didn't step into that car. He reached into that." Does any of that make a difference to you? If you even ask that question, I would dare say you'd be fired before midnight. And so I don't know where this goes, man. It's to me, it's very distressing when the truth doesn't matter, and you can't have, you know, honest discourse. And so to me, Lauren Serrano's article is emblematic of that, in that if I do what I'm supposed to do, and those are the kind of people, the Pete Ellenses, the people that are mavericks, that will think, you know, General Gray, for God's sakes, and his discussion of maneuver warfare, were it not for those kind of people, you know, the intellectual lifeblood of organizations and dare I say our service, you know, is a slow, murky swamp that goes nowhere. So I'm a little bit distressed, if you can't tell.
Well, no, and that comes through loud and clear.
Thank you.
And I think anyone would be distressed looking at the country writ large. Now, I will also tell you that, you know, having the discussion in order to improve, in order to fix whatever problems there are out there on any side of the issue, having the discussion in a respectful, constructive way and an open way is the first step towards that. So, you know, some folks might think that it's not appropriate to have that sort of discussion connected with the professional journal of the Marine Corps. I disagree.
Oh, my God. So are you kidding me?
I've been approached by a number of officers who are really following through on the commandant's direction. And General Berger himself has given guidance that we need to have the discussion in the Marine Corps, and we need to be talking about these issues. And so, starting this month, we're gonna open up a call to action on the Gazette blog, taking this issue of race in the Marine Corps head on. And there's a couple of articles we're working on right now that will be connected to that blog and blog post. And we, you know, we're inviting the discourse. I will tell you also that we're gonna moderate that discourse. If there's things that are not constructive, that are not suitable for publication, those aren't gonna see the light of day.
Are you gonna start with the New York Times article from the other day?
I will reference the article about Colonel Henderson, about Tony right. Henderson.
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know that it's fair to make, you know, Colonel Henderson, you know, but it's hard not to make him the subject when he's being used to prove the point. but it's unfair to him because he doesn't, I don't know that he wanted the article written. He didn't comment in the article, but it's like, well, if we're going to take up that issue in which three boards passed on the guy, in which the commandant chaired one of them, I believe, then how do we not talk about that? And so how do you do that, Woody? Good luck on that shit.
We'll see how it goes, but I think it's important enough that it needs to happen.
Right. All right, let's do something a little bit less deadly for you and me. What about this month? Intelligence is the theme of September Gazette, I think. Talk to us about it.
That's right. It's and it's interesting how these warfighting functional areas, domains, are interrelated and are crossing over together. But your September Gazette is focused primarily on the Marine Corps Intelligence Surveillance Reconnaissance Enterprise, or MCISRE. So all pieces, parts of intel as a community and as a warfighting function. But again, because of the nature of our current environment, it's inextricably linked with operations in the information environment, OIE or what we used to call C4I, and right. And it became C4ISR. And these are all under the purview of Lieutenant General Reynolds, Deputy Commandant for Information, and they are extraordinarily different at the tactical level, but fundamentally, they are reliant on a lot of the same information systems, and they exist in the same information domain. So you've got a mix, really, almost a 50-50 mix of intelligence-focused articles and then the other aspects of operations in the information environment that relate directly and indirectly to intelligence. It's a narrow subject area, but when we think about, you mentioned the South China Sea and the potential of a fight, a near peer or peer fight in that area, the intelligence fight, the reconnaissance counter reconnaissance fight, and the fight in the information environment may in fact be in the area of decision in a fight like that.
I believe it is. I believe that, if you look at, in fact, there's an interesting article because there was a study published yesterday on, and it's, the headlines are reverberating the last 24 hours about a DOD study on Chinese military and their intentions, yes. Blah, 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 blah. And so there's an article, I think in, I don't know if it's Military Times or military.com, one of them, about what war with China will look like. Well, if you say, okay, the cables that run through the Malaccan Straits, the internet cables, those will be cut, right? Your satellites are going to be nudged, right? Or flat out destroyed. So we're going to lose those assets. And then in that environment now that will mirror Vietnam era without satellite communication things. So it's going to be more kind of like Vietnam with more sophisticated assets, obviously, that decides it, in my opinion. I mean, who has the greatest ability in that environment that's the beginning of air superiority that we use all the time. If you look at American, military operations, number one is establish air superiority. Well, before air superiority is going to come space superiority and digital communication superiority. Yeah. And if you can maintain yours and destroy somebody else's, you win and they'll lose. And then it's a question of time till you can establish air superiority, which then begets every other form of superiority. So I think it's people like to goof on the Space Force and the logo and William Shatner. Should the commanders of Space Force units be, captains or colonels and all that nonsense? But the bottom line is the Space Force will be they will operate in the realm of the decision. And if they can't do what they're supposed to do or what we need them to do, the butcher bill for every other thing goes up in a exponential fashion.
I think you're exactly right, and it extends, you know, some of the mental shorthand on this is, you know, who is seen first, who is blinded first, in terms of the reconnaissance counter reconnaissance fight. It goes beyond that to what conditions are set in the information environment, particularly in the electromagnetic spectrum, in space, in cyberspace, in our terrestrial and satellite communications.
Right.
So it's almost changing your view on this, that the preconditions, what happens before any more conventional or kinetic activity or movement even takes place, sets the stage for victory or defeat.
Well, I mean, and I hear this thing like, you know, we're about to enter a Cold War phase with the Chinese. Look, unless you've been sleepwalking through life, right? That's been going on for 20 plus years as they've been stealing our technology. They've been at war with us. We just have decided to pretend, another version of the Emperor's New Clothes, that, yeah, that's not really going on. We want to trade with them. I'm for free trade. One of my favorite quotes from Orrin Hatch, a conservative. Orrin, if you think that's free trade, I got some oceanfront property I want to sell you in Iowa. Good God. And so the mere realization that, you know, that, and I think what it comes down to, if we go back to Cold War stuff, is the Chinese have to know, and the Russians too, although in my opinion, to a lesser extent, the Chinese have to know that any venture into that realm will lead to the destruction of their country, either as a communist state or as a state period. But the concept of mutually assured destroyables, you know, has to be in their firmly in their brain. And so, to me, that Cold War is real, and the Space Force, in my opinion, to me, is the just became the decisive branch of the military. And there's Marines now at the Space Force. Did you know that, Woody?
Oh, absolutely, yes.
Oh, yes. I didn't know. I didn't know if a knuckle dragger like you knew that kind of stuff.
We use our traditional rank structure as well. You know, majors, not lieutenant commanders, you know, that sort of thing.
So, we do.
But you know, you make a really good point, and there have been some very broad generalizations made about you know, the renewal of great power competition and you know, a new or renewed Cold War. Those are you know, valid analogies and valid statements, but you need to go one step further and start looking at what really characterized the Cold War, and I'll define that as the Cold War between the West, primarily the United States and NATO, against the USSR and the Soviet bloc. What really characterized that? And you're right. This undeniable trigger of escalation towards nuclear war was probably the dominant characteristic of that era. That's both a tremendous risk, but also a control on what actually occurs. The second piece to that is the struggle between ideologies, which for one reason or another we're not keen on focusing on today as a difference between ideologies between us and the People's Republic of China. But then the third piece being looking at and analyzing how we quote unquote won that Cold War, what we did that caused in many ways the internal collapse of our adversary. And so part of that, beyond the mutual assured destruction threat, beyond the credibility of conventional deterrence, was the ability to outspend your opponent. And so looking at it through those lenses can be informative if we are in fact going to embark or have already been caught in a cold war in the with the People's Republic of China and South China Sea theater, and more broadly globally and in the information environment.
Well, what's the
if we're caught in that situation, then by God, let's win it.
Well, but what happens if the fundamental change between, you know, doing it with the Soviet Union and doing this with the Chinese is you're not going to outspend, you know, you're not going to be able to spend your way out of it. You're now competing with a peer and maybe a superior in terms of economics should they continue to expand. And so to me, what's really interesting, and in my opinion, the implication of this is our alliances become much more significant. And that although, you know, that the alliance between Australia, Japan, the United States, South Korea, and then hopefully nations like Malaysia, Vietnam, maybe someday again the Philippines, that's the trick. The same thing, you know, that we've seen in what is it called, the European Defense Initiative, and now you're starting to see it in its embryonic stages in the Indo-Pacific Defense Initiative and this pivot to the Pacific. But to me, the free nations of the world that look at China and say, we're not going to play this stupid game anymore, okay? We're not going to allow you to punish the Australians for saying in public, we want and we believe it's necessary to have an independent inquiry into how this COVID-19 thing got going, and then how it got transmitted all over the world. And that all of a sudden China decides, oh, really? We're going to pinch you off, you know, economically, destabilize your government, cause regime change in your country if we can, and we're going to prey upon you by every other means other than kinetic. And so to me, if the free nations of the world will not stand up together and say, we're not going to have this. If you do that to one of us, you do that to all of us. Then we're going to have a rough time with China because we don't have that economic super advantage anymore that we had over, you know, over the Russians that saw the Russians go to the ash heap of history, as President Reagan predicted and spoke about.
These sorts of issues, these come under the umbrella of strategy and policy,
right?
Which, as we know, no military service makes our national strategy or national security strategy, defense strategy. We inform it, but we are influenced by it, and therefore, frankly, there hasn't been a lot of content in the Gazette in this subject area. That's changing, really, starting September and next month's magazine, and we're going to have a topic area within our monthly ideas and issues dedicated to strategy and policy, largely focused on defense strategy and security strategy, but also to a degree foreign policy as it influences the necessary alliances, theater security cooperation, etc. And again, a yardstick on this is, you know, how these issues that are beyond the scope of even the commandant's responsibility, how they influence the employment of Marine forces by the combatant commander. So that'll actually you've got an article in the September magazine by Second Lieutenant Sybil Greenberg, The Age of Chinese Espionage, that talks about the threat and potential changes to our intelligence enterprise based on that threat. And then next month, as a coming attraction in October, we'll actually be opening that new topical area with a first in a series of articles on our strategic competition with China.
All right, I've got a couple emails. One, Mac, would Woody tell us where to find this discussion about race that the Gazette will sponsor?
Yes, you'll find that. You're going to be able to find that on our website on the Gazette blog. So www.mca-marines.org Gazette. We'll get you to the Gazette homepage, and then you'll see where the blog is. And then anyone can read the call to action and the posts, and members of the association can make comments and do their own posts. And depending on the volume of interest, I have a workaround, if you will, a back door whereby I allow Marines at large, non-members, to participate in that discussion as well. And we expect that'll go live the week of 10 September.
Got it. Next question. I heard something thrown around on Almarine Radio the other day, and I'm wondering if Woody could validate it. Is it true that the selection rate for women between lieutenant colonel and colonel approaches 100%? Woody, do you know? Somebody sent that to me. Is that true?
Well, first of all, I don't know because I don't have current stats on that in front of me. I could certainly, if somebody wants to shoot me an email, I can find out and let you all know. But from lieutenant colonel to colonel, I would be surprised. It may be within some MOSs, but I'd be surprised if any of our promotion statistics are 100% across the board. I mean, it's not even 100% to get from second lieutenant to first lieutenant anymore. And that used to be, free with a bet.
Yeah, you had to malfunction at the ball with the commandant's wife to not be included in that group.
Exactly.
And not too many people did that. There was one other question I was going to ask you off the top of my head. No, it's interesting times we live in. But again, I go back to, Major Serrano's question. Can you participate in these discussions and not have it held against you? And let me use that as kind of an introduction to this email. In listening to Woody, what I heard was a mixed response, that even though that's not the way we want it, that sometimes there are those repercussions. Is that what I heard, Woody?
I think that's fairly accurate. I would expand on that and say, held against you by whom? And I hate to put it this way, but held against you by anybody who matters? I mean, the fact of the matter is, if you're excoriated in a Facebook group or on someone's blog or a website, or even in major print media, if you're excoriated that way in a public forum by those sorts of folks, who I would really characterize as not really mattering in the career path of a right. of a Marine officer. Well, so what?
I assume the question was by people that matter.
Yeah. So I would disagree with that. I firmly believe that the people who matter, meaning the leadership of the Marine Corps, and be that in a local chain of command up through the senior leadership. Again, as long as the statements, as the discussion that were the source of this criticism was rightly intended, was again meets those four criteria that I'd sort of laid out. I don't believe the leadership that matters can or would hold that against an author or an officer of any rank, be it officer or enlisted.
I would say this. It matters who's in charge, and it matters their taste for intellectual discourse. I would tell you this. My experience with General Mattis is that if he read that and it was articulate and it was constructive, he'd want to meet you. Now, I've experienced with other people that I won't name that are general officers that they would read that and go, okay, yeah, that's interesting. and then say, yeah, probably not on my staff. And it just depends on, I think, people's appetite for intellectual discourse and how they feel about it. And not everybody is uniform in that regard. And so I think it depends. But I would say this. Do you really want to live your life worrying about that stuff? I think you live your life the way you should live it. And if somebody doesn't like it, screw them and go on about your life. Because I think the people that are thinkers, if the cost of being part of an organization is the fact that you can't say what you think, then it's not worth it. It is not worth it. To me, you need to say what you think, and the chips will fall where they fall. And I think throughout history, people that have been outspoken have tended at some point to pay a price for that by not rising to, you know, the top of the organization. And I think that's a fact. And if you want to be, there's a level of conformity that you have to accept if you want to rise to top spots. And I think General Gray is an anomaly. The only reason Gray exists was because another anomaly existed, and that is the form of Jim Webb as Secretary of the Navy. Without Gray, without Webb, right, there would never been Al Gray, and the Marine Corps would not have embraced maneuver warfare. You know, so it's kind of interesting the impact of some of these people. Just my thought.
As I think you know, we've got an ongoing series of articles on maneuver warfare in the September edition. You've got some of the both September and October have the backstory, the origin story, if you will, from the point of view of how the service began this transition to maneuver warfare. Might be worth a letter to the editor, to the authors, to ask that question. What was the influence? Because we know it was General Gray driving it.
Right.
But what was the influence of Secretary Webb in that as well?
Right.
So,
right.
And these are the articles are anonymous, but I they're very well informed as far as that information from the early days. So that would be definitely love to get that as part of the discussion.
Well, no, I mean, you institutionally, you know, Webb's appointment, Gray's appointment, Gray's nomination, and the impact he had on the service. I mean, you know, I mean, there's people that, I mean, guys like General Zinni that call, you know, and General Van Riper called, you know, General Gray the father of the modern Marine Corps. And, I mean, that's huge, right? A huge statement for a guy who was what, like fifth or sixth on the list,
right?
And doesn't get there without Secretary Webb being Secretary Webb. So interesting. All right,
a mentor of mine once told me that if you're walking around in the field and you see a box turtle sitting on top of a fence post, you know one thing for sure: he didn't get there on his own.
I don't know. I don't know how appropriate that analogy is given our sensitivity there, Woody. Give me. It's a pretty interesting one, though, for any of us who know the history of the box turtle and our desperate fight to both preserve and avoid that son of a bitch. What about give me two articles to read this month, one in the print version and one in the online version.
So for September in the print version, there is that maneuverist paper out there.
What's the title of it?
It's called Marine Corps Maneuver Warfare, and it is very much the origin story,
okay,
if you will, of.
And they're they're anonymous, like the Federalist Papers.
That is correct. Oh. In fact, if you read back to the June-July issues, we started this out with a declaration by two maneuverists, which is essentially, you know, fills sort of the role of the Declaration of Independence. If you then continue the analogy and look at FMFM1/MCDP1 as the Constitution, the maneuverist papers that are being published in sequence now are in fact the analogy to the Federalist Papers, how Hamilton and Monroe and Madison commented on the Constitution in its its earliest forms there.
Notice how savvy I am and how quick I picked that up. I hope when you talk about me with your friends that are bad-mouthing me, they say, well, hold on. McNamara is so quick on the uptake. It's ridiculous.
Exactly. As far as online offerings, I'm gonna move the target a little bit because I want everyone listening to have an opportunity to visit the website and find. I mentioned that we've been able to branch out into some areas here during the pandemic response, the quarantine period, and really get some additional work done, frankly. And so if you're on our website, you'll find a tab at the top of the page called Professional Development. And what we've done is collected together and curated an enormous collection of resources for Marines and leaders of Marines to really get after what the Commandant and what Training and Education Command and MCDP7 Learning point to as far as self-education and lifelong learning. And so in that professional development collection, you've got everything from battle study guides, really all over the world. We're building a one-stop shop for maps, study guides, logistics resources for everywhere from Gettysburg, Fredericksburg to Okinawa and everywhere in between for use either as classroom, barracks room, individual small unit study, or when we start moving about and traveling more again for actual physical staff rides of these battlefields. There are collections by topic from archival material, so we've essentially started curating our archives so that, as an example, if you want to read what Marines and other authors were thinking and writing about the last time we did a Cold War, the last time we were involved in great power competition, there is a collection of material from the pages of the Gazette that was written really between 1955, 54, and 1964. So end of Korea through the beginnings of the escalation in Vietnam, Marines writing about nuclear war, about containment of the Soviet Union, and those sorts of topics. So
I've said that about the pages of the Gazette relative to great power competition and fighting a peer, and that read the stories written by Marines about the fighting in the northern part of I Corps in, pick a year, 66, 67, 68, 69, 70s, any time, when, you know, the Marine Corps and 3rd Marine Division took on the North Vietnamese Army, I want to say the 90th Division or whatever, 90th, I can't remember, the 90th Corps or whatever the hell it was. But you want to understand what it was when somebody else would put your head on a stick. And I read something somebody sent to me, and they it had to do with Operation Buffalo, and they were with Alpha Company 1-9. Bravo Company 1-9 is the one that got hammered. Alpha Company tried to get to them and was stymied. They then get pulled back, and then 2 days later they get told to take a reconnaissance team up to the is it the Benhai River in the DMZ, and they're trying to find how the North Vietnamese are getting across the river so quick. And they wind up occupying a North Vietnamese kind of company firm base. And they flop into it as a North Vietnamese battalion comes diddy-popping down the trail, right, in an administrative movement, right, with hogs slung to bamboo posts, women mm-hmm. with chickens on their back, and they're kind of humping through the DMZ headed south. And they walk into this Marine Rifle Company, and they essentially – and they annihilate them. But what they found was they had built a series of bamboo steps that were just below the waterline of the river. And it looked like this NVA battalion simply walked across the river. Honestly, I mean, just amazing to read this stuff. So to me, the richness of what's in the Gazette, when you go back and read those accounts of how they unfolded, and most of them tend to have maps and whatnot, it's if you don't do that, you're not very smart. You shouldn't be listening to this program.
We made it easier to do that, again, by curating, collecting together a lot of this archival material by topics and by subject areas. If you've ever had any interest in what every commandant of the Marine Corps since 1916 has written in the Gazette, we have the commandant's words as a collection there. You'd be interesting to see which commandants have written the most for the professional journal. We've got a variety of curated subject areas there. We've got reference pages. If you want one stop shop to find every strategy document, all joint service doctrinal publications, links to other service libraries, joint libraries, all of that is now collected together in that professional development page. That's my plug for an online resource.
Well, let me just tell you, and I talk about this when I do post-traumatic winning, and I talk about counseling. I said, I'm embarrassed to say nobody ever taught me how to counsel, and we don't teach it in our formal schools. We teach the performance evaluation system. We don't teach how to have a conversation. The only people that get taught how to have a conversation are recruiters. And so I said, look, if you haven't read the Marine Corps Order on Counseling, if you haven't perused the Army, the Navy, and Air Forces for best practices, and you haven't done the same thing in the civilian world, are you serious about what you're doing? Because you're fundamentally ignorant about your craft. Now, those are strong words, and I mean it, because the tie rod that keeps people from killing themselves is that you give a shit, that you help them. And I play audio from General Mattis that says, the only reason I stuck around this low-paying outfit for 40 years was because of the cocky, rambunctious Marines. And he goes on. He says, and if you don't love them, you should get out. And then I played audio from General Furness that says, you've got to know them better, right? And so it's through knowing them better that then allows you to help them and make their lives better, that is the form of love that General Mattis is looking for. And that's the tie rod that shows them that we care, that we're involved by deed, not by word. And that's the tie rod. And so these things that these resources that Woody is talking about, those resources are the resources you need to truly be a professional, to be the leader that Marines and anybody that's on active duty needs you to be, and not just the next jackass that's in charge. And so that's why the professional arm of the Marine Corps is what Woody's a custodian for.
About our combat power.
Oh, my God. Absolutely.
Our people are our combat power. And so those quote unquote people skills, and I can't think of one that's more of a people skill than conversation or counseling. You got to learn it.
Oh my God. I had this great conversation with a lot of sergeant majors and battalion commanders and some regimental commanders down at the 2nd Marine Division, you know, about, you know, how do you, how about sustaining this stuff? And they talk about, well, you know what? The key person in that chain is the first sergeant. When you report to a company, because the majority of people that counsel in the Marine Corps are themselves novices, lieutenants and sergeants. They're novices in the scheme of the world. So how do you get them to leadership 401? And I thought General Furness laid this out really well. They naturally operate at leadership 101 and 201. We need them to get to 401. Who moves them there? And the answer from, you know, the battalion commanders, sergeant majors, was, and it wasn't unanimous, but it was the first sergeant. What better way for the first sergeant to get to know young officers, young sergeants, than to sit them down kneecap to kneecap and say, okay, let me show you about the conversation that you have to have on a monthly basis. All right, if it's only about performance and conduct, you're not. If you don't know that they're restoring their Mustang, if you don't know that their sister's got a multiple fraction of her leg, then you don't know them. If you don't know them, you can't help them. So that's where this has to start, because better human being, better Marine, better warfighter, more lethal, fill in the blank. More lethal 15th Mew, more lethal 2MAF, more lethal 2nd MAW, fill in the blank. But that's where it starts. And so, and then what better way for a young lieutenant or a young sergeant to learn this craft than sitting down with the most senior enlisted Marine in the organization and learning it kneecap to kneecap with the company commander piling on. And I was like, holy shit, making progress here, boys and girls. Not sure everybody's paying attention. But it was kind of substantive kind of discussion that, you know, that you and I talk about here.
Yeah, well, it makes you, you know, it makes you a more durable, more resilient human too. And I think that gets after where you go with post-traumatic winning. There's no substitute for that genuine concern, human interaction.
Well, I'll tell you this. I deal with a couple of observations since you asked. I'm surprised at the amount of sexual violence that I encounter that happens to people long before they join the Marine Corps. But it's a consistent theme. I just had my roommate from IOC tell me that he was sexually assaulted twice in his life. Hadn't talked about it, but started listening to this program about a year ago, All Marine Radio, and heard me, all the interviews I'd done with people relative to post-traumatic winning. Heard an interview I did with a woman by the name of Stacy Falzerano, whose husband, Tom, was a colonel wing commander at Peterson Air Force Base. He was CO of the 21st Space Wing. Yeah, so, and a fast mover, Air Force Academy grad. And Stacy is herself, she's a PhD. Her specialty is Chinese space operations. So when I talked to Marines, I was with the 15th Mew a couple weeks ago, and I said, look, we could grind up all of our brains in this room right now and stuff them into one skull. She's still smarter than we are, okay? And in her time of need, in which both the Air Force and the Space Force offered her everything that they could offer her, who did she pick up the phone and call? She called me, and what was she looking for? The traumatic wisdom, what I call the flat black wisdom, you know, the flat black traumatic wisdom of Marines. And that's how powerful this stuff, and if you want to move people in their life, you got to care about them. And you're right, Woody, it is, it's being that custodian and leading in that realm that if you won't go there, you know, in my opinion, you know, you're not a leader. And so to me, those, all those assets and that discussion, I mean, that's hugely part of what it is to be a professional. But it is these things go. So to me, that you don't need a new program to send those destructive behavior statistics down. You've got to have a frank discussion and what I call flat black wisdom. And that is, you're not going to get over it. If you want to self-medicate, look, we as a Corps, born in a tavern, we've gone down that road. I mean, shit, we paved it. We've striped it. We've lit it. And we can tell you this, it never ends well, ever, okay? And so if you can't live with some self-discipline relative to alcohol consumption, physical fitness, right, financially, we can tell you where the hell you're going, right? And that is just the truth. And then if you'll turn around and take these truths and help everybody you can, watch what happens to your life. And honestly, it's the most amazing thing. You see Lance Corporals that save people's lives and send you these incredible emails because we've shared this shit with them. And there was a time for a lot of time in the Marine Corps that, you know, that we didn't talk about this stuff. We didn't share this shit. I've interviewed guys who were part of the brigade who, you know, they went to boot camp on ships, right, headed over to Japan, and then they participated in the landing in Incheon. And they said nobody ever talked about their combat experience. Like, this is what you're going to experience. This is what it's going to be like. Didn't talk about it. And so then when you came home, we didn't talk about it either. And Woody, you and I both grew up in the Marine Corps that it was acceptable to be a high-functioning alcoholic in the Marine Corps. You know, we would drag you home on mess night. We would find you when some shitter passed out. You know, we would throw you in the car, take you home to your wife, and, you know, we'd all act like nothing happened the next day. And hopefully these discussions are changing that, and they're life-changing events for people, and then what they're willing to discuss changes. And to me, it's inspirational. You know, the more people that do this, and then the other people that it impacts. And like I say, I was so happy to get Stacy Falzer on his phone call. I mean, I had read about the incident where her husband, he came home to PT and had a massive heart attack and died. And I knew that she had seen it. I said, I don't remember if I met her, but I know she's had to be there that day at Peterson Air Force Base. And lo and behold, I get this phone call. And what is she reaching out for? The traumatic wisdom of the flat black Marine Corps, mostly sergeant and below, that is the dominant influence in post-traumatic winning. And I have to tell you, I mean, I absolutely love it because our culture, to me, is the best. It is raw. It is rough and tumble, but more than anything else, it is bred on winning and people that want to win. And that's why they endure what they're not sure they can get through. That's why that crucible ceremony is so emotional because, you know, most of us weren't sure that we would get through that stuff. We thought we would, but, you know, weren't exactly sure. And then it happens, and that's the sign of a different cat. And Woody and I have seen him in combat, and take your breath away. In my opinion, the most emotional things I've ever seen in my life have been young Marines who didn't know that they would survive a hail of gunfire and went into it anyway, not knowing what would happen. And so again, the sharing of that wisdom with them and these discussions, and you were the primary steward of it, Woody, in my opinion. I can't tell you, and I shouldn't say this to you, to your face, but or to your ears, but your efforts to expand the reach of the Gazette, to diversify the way it's delivered, and to create additional content with all the writings of the commandants, to me is noble and is absolutely what you should be doing. So keep doing that shit and don't screw it up.
Wilco.
All right. One final thing. Somebody just sent me a note. Have you ever heard the 90-minute interview that Studs Terkel did with Gene Sledge?
No.
I'm going to send you two links. I found this because Gene Sledge is an interesting character. He and Manchester cope with their traumatic experiences by taking the writer's way out. In a culture where you couldn't talk about it, they wrote about it. And that's how they dealt with it, which is interesting. And I'm interested. Sledge, I find an interesting guy because he's so smart. And he's so deeply thought about these things. And so I see this interview, you know, Studs Terkel, and there's six parts to it. And I'm like, you got to be kidding me. So I take it and I played it for everybody. And it is absolutely wonderful. Sledge in that Southern drawl, right? Terkel's, and Terkel's doing research for The Good War in about 1984. With the Old Breed comes out in 1981. And so... Then I find Sledge's digital archives that are at Auburn University, which is another little find. The letters he writes, the letters he's kept, and things like that, which are pretty cool. But I'll send you the links. It's 90 minutes of heaven as Terkel's trying to put together this book, right? And The Good War is about no war is good, but the perception, right, versus the everyday reality of World War II that people lived with. And so Turkle, this very unique and guy from Chicago, grew up in a boarding house, so was introduced in to the flavors of the American culture at a young age, and saw the plight of the working person, and you know, wrote about it for years. And so, but I'm going to tell you, 90 minutes of absolute heaven, listening to the depth of Gene Sledge, his thoughts in long format. And so, you can say you're welcome at some other time.
I will, and it's appropriate. Recognized today, 75 years ago, is the formal signing of the instrument of surrender for the Empire of Japan on board Battleship Missouri.
I was at 8th and I a year or so ago, and I was in the flag room and with their commanding officer and Mike Musselman. And there was a flag that it looked a Marine Corps flag looked a little different, was on a different rack. And so we're standing there. I said, "What's that?" He said, "Oh, we just got that." He said, "And we're waiting for the museum to take it. But that is those are the Marine Corps colors that marched through Tokyo at the head of the Marines that marched into there the day after or whenever they had the parade."
Right.
right? You're just like, holy smokes, man, look at that. But, yeah, huge day. Well, Woody, I've taken up too much of your time. First of all, congratulations on all you're doing. And I know next time I have you back on, which won't be as long, I promise, I want you to update us on the digital, you know, stuff that you're doing relative to interviews and stuff like that, I believe with the University of North Carolina, yes?
Yes.
And so I'm because let me tell you, listening to Gene Sledge talk about, you know, his time in the Pacific, his thoughts on coming home, his thoughts in long format with Studs Terkel, the fighting, some of the different stories that he tells in long format, it was just absolutely wonderful. I know you guys are headed down that road, which just kind of unleashes, you know, the magical history of an incredible organization, which is the United States Marine Corps. So I'm a huge fan.
Appreciate it. Thanks
all right,
much.
Yeah, thanks, Woody. See you.
All right. Thanks, Mac. Out here.
There you have it. Chris Woodbridge on a Tuesday. I took up too much of Woody's time. But, no, they're doing great things. And let me tell you, I don't know if revolutionized is too strong of a word. But he's changing that organization, and pretty impressive. All right, that'll do it. If you're just tuning in hour one, talk about the Vice President's National Security Advisor is a retired Lieutenant General by the Army Lieutenant General by the name of Kellogg. And in a moment of incredible candor, he calls John Bolton a liar and a fabricator.
Yeah.
A retired Army Lieutenant General. So you want to hear that. And then let's see, what else are you going to hear? And then you hear Woody. And we have a wide-ranging liberal arts discussion. At some point he's going to say, "Mac, at some point, come on. We need to talk about the magazine more." But it's all right. He's good to have on. He's a good guy. Anyway, have a great Tuesday. On this Tuesday, All Marine Radio. Over and out.